What we've been doing, for those of you that are new, is we've talked about Peter as a rhetorical device. That Peter has something he wants to say, a very specific thing that he wants to say to his audience. And his audience is specifically diaspora Jews, Jews that had been scattered by the Romans throughout the empire, and they had all settled in Asia Minor. Many of them had settled in Asia Minor. And Peter is writing them to say to them from Rome, where Nero has just begun to persecute Christians, hey, wake up. Persecution's coming your way. What I see in Rome, I see Nero killing Christians, it's coming your way. And I know you've been outcasts as diaspora Jews, but it's coming more intensely. And so he's telling his audience, the key thing he's telling his audience is be holy in everything you do. And we've talked about his arguments as he goes through that. And this is his fifth argument where he turns the corner and talks about leadership in the local church. Because if a church is going to be beleaguered, leadership matters and is really, really important. So this morning we're talking about, frankly, again, if you're visiting, this is a really awkward passage to teach. This is the kind of passage, usually as a pastor, you get somebody from the outside to come in and tell everybody how they're supposed to submit to their pastor. It's weird for me to stand up here and teach a passage that says, submit to your pastor, which I think this passage is not saying. Just to be clear, don't check out and walk out. We're going to work through it and talk about what this all looks like. All right, fair enough? Deep breath. Well, I'm scanning the room, and most of you probably weren't alive in 1978, but if you opened your newspaper on November 18th, 1978, this means a whole lot to you, right? You remember this event. Some of you are nodding, betraying your age, all right? So November 18th, 1978, if you were to pick up, I would guess, any paper in the United States, or actually on November 19th, if you had picked up the paper any place in the United States, probably the headlines that day, I would assume they were headlines, was that 918 people had died in Jonestown in Guyana. That a group called, the People's Temple out of San Francisco had relocated to Guyana because of increasing pressure from the U.S. government to get away from the government. They were socialist, kind of communistic, Christian-ish, all those things kind of mashed together. And they had fled, and there was some, there had been some investigations done, and there had been an article run in the San Francisco Chronicle, I think, that had exposed some abuses in the church and some tax issues and all kinds of stuff. And so that night at their compound, 909 people drank cyanide-laced Kool-Aid and died. And the pictures are gruesome. I didn't want to put them because we have kids in here. But the pictures are pretty gruesome. 909 people died at the compound. And then a U.S. senator was gunned down at an airport trying to escape and get out of here. And several others were killed. So basically what had happened is they were convinced that the government was coming, and they had actually practiced what they called, I don't know why they called them this, but they called them white knights, where they would practice what happens when the government comes. And Jim Jones, the leader of this group, gave them four options. You can either flee to Russia, fight back, commit revolutionary suicide, or flee to the jungle. And on at least two occasions prior to that night, the group there elected to commit revolutionary suicide and walked forward and drank Kool-Aid thinking that they were actually doing so. And at the end, he told them, nah, just kidding. That was a test of your loyalty. So twice before they had gone through this, and on this night, they actually did mix cyanide into it and committed mass suicide, except for Jim Jones. And it appears that he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. So the question is, I don't know if this troubles any of you, the question is, how do normal-ish people, how do people like us end up doing something like that? Where does it go so wrong? How do you go from normal church experience, normal everyday life, to drinking cyanide-laced Kool-Aid in a jungle in South America? Several years ago, I read this book called Churches That Abuse by this guy named Ronald Emroth. He studies cults in America. And so he did a study, and this came out in 1991, and so it's a little bit dated. But he looks at different groups like Jonestown, like the Heaven's Gate people. Remember those guys? Guys that thought the alien ship was coming behind the Halley Bopp comet, and they had their white tennis shoes on to meet the UFO in the sky. How do groups like that spring up? What happens? And they started going through some of the characteristics of groups like this. That these kind of groups have very control-oriented leadership. leadership, that the leadership is trying to make sure it controls the populace. This is what Jim Jones did. And we'll look at this one in just a second, but they controlled information in such a way to make sure the people didn't really know what was going on and the people could be controlled and manipulated. That churches that abuse manipulate the members and create this idea of dependency, that you really need us to survive. They create this idea that persecution is coming. Remember David Koresh? That happened when I was in high school or college, where he had this prophecy that the government is going to knock down our doors. And then he stockpiled guns, assuring that what would happen is the government did knock down his doors. And so they create this scenario in which people believe they're after us, and we're the only ones that see it clearly. We're the only ones that have the truth. We get it, and they're coming after us. Groups like this have a lifestyle rigidity to them. When people lived at Jonestown in South America, they had a strict work day followed by, they were following the North Korean model of mind control, where you work for 8 hours a day, you study 8 hours a day of how awesome it is to be a communist. That was how their day was structured, so that they would be, they had this lifestyle rigidity. There was harsh discipline of members. People were killed trying to escape from Jonestown. There was an emphasis on experience. So whereas most of us come and we look at the Bible, let's say, and we say, what does the Bible say and how do we live it out? They do the reverse. They say, here's what I'm telling you to do, and if you can't disprove it from the Bible, then we know it's true. So it'd be like me standing up here this morning saying, all Christians have to wear white tennis shoes next week. Prove me wrong. And if you can't use the Bible to prove me wrong, which you can't, everybody has to wear white tennis shoes next week. You understand how that's opposite of the way most of us think about our faith, that we look at it and go, oh, this is how we live. It's backwards the other way. And then finally, there is a painful exit process in Jonestown, and in many of those, sometimes death, but oftentimes when you read Enroth's book, you hear stories of people who say, I left that group, and then I never saw my wife again. I never saw my kids again. I never got any of the money back that I put in. There's a painful exit process to all that. So how does all these things happen? I think a lot of this roots in, and I had somebody talk to me after the first service for a little bit, misapplications of passages just like this. That we read something like Lisa just read, and we pull one line out of this whole paragraph, and the line that we pull out is what? Everyone do what? Submit to those in authority over you. And so a leader, a charismatic leader, stands up in front of everybody and holds up their Bible and says, it says that you all are supposed to submit to me, and therefore this is what you will do. White tennis shoes for everybody next week. And that's dangerous. Anytime we start pulling out a section or a phrase or a word and use that to be the whole thing when it's much bigger than that is a dangerous, dangerous place to be. So we're going to read the passage again, just a minute. You can go ahead and start turning to 983 in your pew Bible. But before you do, I want to give you a picture of what leadership looked like in the early church. Now, oftentimes, depending on what tradition you come from, well, most of our traditions that we come from, we have denominational or organizational structures. So those of you that grew up Presbyterian, how is a Presbyterian church led? Yeah, so the local church is led by a group of elders, led by a group of the presbytery, led by the session. Is that right how it goes? Sure, all right. How many of you grew up Catholic? What's the structure? Priest, bishop, cardinal. Big man, all right? Pope. All right, so there's a structure there. If you grew up in a Baptist church, how does it work? It could actually work one of two ways. I'll give any one who's right. Nobody knows? I'll tell you. All right, in some contexts, because I know this one, in some contexts, I'm doing this on purpose, in some contexts in a Baptist church, it is the pastor. The pastor is the authority, and everybody else submits. That's how this passage is read. I'm the authority, you submit to me. In other contexts, the congregation is king. We call them congregational churches, where it's the congregation who sits up here. And so right when we're done with service this morning, we're going to have a quick vote. I want to change out the toilet paper roll in the bathroom, and I need the congregation to weigh in on that real quick because the congregation makes all the decisions in the church. I'm being a little bit facetious, just a little bit. All right? I have been in church votes on carpet. You know, like that's a congregational setting. All right? Now, want me to tell you which one of those is right? All of them and none of them all at the same time. All of them take pieces of scripture and this thing and that thing and say, well, it's this because of this and this and that. But what happens in the early church, and many of them, I think almost all of them, go back to the early church and say, well, this is how they did it in the early church. We're just doing what the early church did. We're obviously doing it the way Jesus did. All right? So at Imago Dei Church, we have our leadership structure. I'm just going to let you all know this morning, we're the ones doing it closest to Jesus. The rest of them are wrong. All right? Which is what we all say, because we all pick and choose. And so a couple things I want to say about the early church is that, first of all, one size doesn't fit all. We can't look at the early church and say, hey, here's what was happening in Corinth, so that must also be what's happening at Ephesus, Jerusalem, Rome, Philippi. We can't assume what happens in one place just happens in every other place in the same way. So most of my gardening at home is stuff I've stolen from my mother. All right. Sometimes I don't actually steal it. Sometimes she just brings stuff to my house and shoves it in the ground and it grows. All right. And so most of the stuff we have is either clippings or starts or bulbs or stuff we've got from my mom, except one key difference. Every year, I'll use my daylilies as an example because they grow out right along the front sidewalk. Every year, it's exciting. We all get excited when the daylilies start coming up, right? They're one of the first things. It means winter's over, spring is coming, they start the green shoots, all that stuff. And I'm usually quite pleased with, you know, that part of the year. And then we'll go over to my mother's house, and her plants that I got the same rootstock from, her stuff is twice as big as mine, always. And I choose to believe it's because she lives in the southern climes of Glassford, that's, you know, 20 miles south of me, that it must be warmer down there, because somehow her stuff is always at least 2 weeks more along than my stuff, right? And I don't know what it is. I think, one, my mom is a magic woman when it comes to plants. There's something that I don't know. Sometimes she says things like, oh, I just threw that in the ground, and then it grew up huge. And I baby things and love them and sing to them, and they don't grow. And so it might be that. It might be the soil. It might be somehow the sun's hitting her plants differently. It could be a thousand things. But we all know that's true, right? Like, just because we have the same plant that came from the same rootstock, we all understand it could grow up a little bit differently over here and a little bit differently here, and depending on where it sits in the yard here, and does it get a cold wind or a north wind, or a, I think those are the same, cold and north. But whatever, we understand that. And in the same way, the early church grew up like that. There's some places in the early church where it grew up this way, and there's some places where it grew up this way, and in some places it did this. And what happens is, when you give it enough time, you get the church developing 200, 300, 400 years down the road, pulling all those together, and you get more of a monolithic understanding of how we're doing leadership in the church. But at least in the time that Peter's writing, it's not that clear. It's kind of muddy everywhere. Everybody has their own little thing. And then secondly, function precedes office. It'd be a mistake for us to read back into history and say, well, Peter is clearly laying out the structure for whatever kind of church that we prefer or whatever system we want to put in place. It just didn't happen that way. What happens? Think about it like anything that you've been a part of. When it develops, it's just kind of muddy. Like, who's the leader? Well, I don't know, that guy, I guess. And as it goes along further, things get more clearly defined. And so Peter's writing very early in the life of the church. And so when we talk about some of the words we're going to put on the screen in just a minute, these aren't like titles in the early church. Some of them are used a little bit like titles. Some of them are used like positions. It's more about what they're doing than an official title. Does that make sense? All right, we're not at that stage of development yet. They haven't printed business cards for the early church. All right, so a couple terms that are going to come up, maybe some of them this morning, some of them just in generic, so just so you know, is apostle. Now, anybody want to give us a definition for apostle? It came to mean people who had directly seen Jesus. So the first apostles were people who had had an encounter with Jesus. What authority do apostles have? When I throw it out there, how much authority do apostles have? Big kahuna authority. Like, so Peter feels, and Paul both feel, that they can pull out the, hey, I'm an apostle thing, to speak to the entire church, geographically, everybody. They feel like that gives them the authority to do all that, right? The next step down is one that we call overseer or bishop. And this is a little bit, again, a little bit fuzzy, but anybody have any ideas about this group? If you were thinking people that directed the whole cities of churches, you'd be right, all right? I know that's what you were going to say, but it appears that overseers or bishops were responsible for multiple churches, which brings us down to the local church and the role of the elder. Elders seem to be localized. When scriptures talk about elders, it seems to be about a specific church, a particular place, a particular group of God's people. And so elders have some things. Now, a couple things I want to say about elders is that this idea of elder comes out of the synagogue tradition. Now, this blows my mind, all right? And I know this is going to sound dumb to some of you. You're going to wonder how I could have gotten through seminary without thinking this. But it just happened a couple days ago. In all my years of talking about leadership in churches, and I've sat through lots of discussions on leadership in church, I have never in my life heard somebody talk about what was happening in the synagogues of Peter's day. But even if you're visiting with me today, I've already told you, who's Peter's audience in this letter? Who's he writing to? Jews. Diaspora Jews who went to synagogue every week. And if you're a Jew and you've started worshiping in this new way, what kind of structure of leadership are you going to copy? Synagogue. The only one that you know. I don't know how I am 30-something years old, and I've never heard this before when I have I've told you all before, I've mastered God, I have my master's of divinity, and somehow I had never even thought through that a synagogue leader was appointed, that they were the ones responsible for doing the rituals, for doing the baby baptisms. They didn't do that, but doing the baby baptisms, they did something much more intrusive. Involved a knife. But the synagogue elder was responsible for running the synagogue, and they were paid to do so. And that's the model, likely, that Peter has in mind. When he starts talking about elders, he has this kind of model in mind. An elder, just to make sure, has nothing, it's not necessarily about one's age. So in the Jewish system of who's old and who's young, anybody want to take a guess? You could be up to what number and still be considered young? 40 plus. You could be in your early 40s and still be called a young leader. Can I get an amen? Amen. Yes, I'm still a young leader, at least for a couple years. And you weren't considered like an elder in terms of chronology until you were 60. And so this language of elder came to be in the early church, not just about who's old and who's young, but who's leading. Elders were leaders in the church. And most often, they were older. Most often, they were the people who could afford homes because the church met in homes, and so you needed some age and prestige to be a head of household, to own a Roman home, to invite people in your home, to have the church. That's mostly what it was. But we find, at least in scriptures, one leader, Timothy, who's considered a younger leader. He's considered at least 40 or so. And so it's not just about age. And the language of this passage, older and younger, is really about leader and everybody else in this passage. Two other terms, deacon. So in Acts, we find that the elders were getting stressed out by the feeding of the people, and it was taking them away from their teaching of scripture. And so they appoint deacons to do the work of the ministry in the early church. This is, again, local office, something that happened at the church, people doing the work of the ministry, people feeding the poor, people teaching the children, people taking care of the needs, hospital visits. They didn't really have hospitals, but if they did, hospital visits, those kinds of things. That's what the deacons are doing. And then another group that some people put on this list, some don't, is prophet, teacher, evangelist, which would have been somebody that would have come and obviously spoken to the local church and probably would have moved around quite a bit, but would have been the expression of that on a weekly basis would have happened in the early church. So the early church lays out these ideas of who these people are, but doesn't give us a strong, like, this is what shall happen. You shall have a deacon who will report to the elder and shall do a quarterly evaluation with the overseer bishop, who will report to the apostle and who will promote you or demote you. It didn't work like that. It was much fuzzier, but this is kind of what it looked like. What was more important to Peter and Paul and the early New Testament writers is style over form. It's more important to them, and we're going to see this in just a second when we read the passage. It's more important to them how leaders, elders, relate to the youngers or the audience or the participants. Their relationship is more important than what the formal structure is. They don't seem worried about structure. They seem worried about Christian virtue and what it means to be Christians in these kind of dynamics. You understand that? All right, let's read. 1 Peter 5, verse 1. I'm going to reread what Lisa read so well, just so it's fresh for us. To the elders among you, I appeal as a fellow elder and a witness of Christ's sufferings, who will also share in the glory to be revealed. Be shepherds of God's flock that is under your care, watching over them, not because you must, but because you are willing, as God wants you to be, not pursuing dishonest gain, but eager to serve, not lording it over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that will never fade away. In the same way, you who are younger, submit yourself to your elders. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, because God opposes the proud, but shows favor to the humble. So what things stick out to you, seem important to you, puzzle you? What impresses you in this? Yeah, so this is just brilliant rhetoric, all right? So Peter calls himself a fellow elder, which is probably true. In his local church, Peter was probably an elder. But Peter's much, much more than that. I told the first service, it would be like Peter, or like me, or it'd be like Michael Jordan entering to the room and saying, Caleb, you and me are both basketball players, all right? Now, I'm not cutting on Caleb's skill at all, but Michael Jordan's skill, yes, they're both basketball players, uh-huh. But it's a little different level, all right? Just a little bit. That's what Peter's doing here, which is really brilliant. He comes along and says, hey, I'm a fellow elder. I get it. But understanding at the same time, and he drops the line right after that about I'm a fellow elder, but hey, I've witnessed Jesus. So just so there's that, I'm a fellow elder, but I've seen Jesus. So here's what I'm saying, right? So it's just really nice rhetoric. He's connecting to his audience, but also asserting his authority in this. Good. What else? Yeah, again, this idea of the synagogue model. That, hey, it's appointed. It's not you must. Your dad did it, so you must therefore. It's nothing like that. Make sure they want to do it. Make sure that they're, yeah, the language of calling, that they're really into it. Yeah, good. What else? Justin? Oh, yeah. So that language of the Pharisees where they lord it over the other people in public, where they love to put on their clothes and let everybody know how righteous they are. But you don't be like them, Jesus taught Peter at some point way in the past. And then he tells them, and this is really the beautiful dance of this, so I want to back you up, all right? Let's jump to another passage for a minute. When I say Ephesians 5, for some of you that strikes fear into your heart, right? What passage is that? It's the submit to your husbands passage. But that passage starts with a command to everyone. And what's the command? Everybody submit to everybody else. And then Paul goes in to say, in the context of everybody submitting to everybody else, let's talk about some of what happens in the family, in a Roman family, okay? Peter's doing the exact same thing here, except he's doing it in reverse. Let's talk about the leaders, let's talk about the followers, but then let's remind each other that the framework in the Christian community is both of these positions are supposed to be lived out in this attitude of humility. Put the idea of clothing yourself humility, put on humility just like you put on a shirt. Choose to put it on as you relate with each other. And so this whole relationship hinges, just like the relationship between husbands and wives hinges on mutual submission, the relationship between elder and younger, between leader and the rest of the church, hinges on this idea that we're all clothing ourselves in humility. It's really a beautiful thing, but it's very tenuous. It only holds together when you're doing all three pieces. And the way you get to a place like Jonestown is you just pick one of those out and say, well, let's just talk about the church submitting to the pastor today. And you just go hard on that all morning long, all right? I couldn't do that. I'm sorry. That'd be just hard. I couldn't look everybody in the face. I'd have to like stand behind here like, all right, here's what it says, people. Do you understand? Like it takes all three of those pieces working together to really make it work. Anybody else? All right, let's break down just real quick. So the first thing he says is to the elders, and there's five things that he says to the elders. It's easy because the congregation gets one thing. The elders get five. And the first one is this reminder that it's God's flock. This is not Charlie Dean's church. It's just not. Never has been, never will be, never should be. Don't refer to it as such, please, because it's not. This reminder that the church is God's. We are all of us together, we're God's people. You're not my people in any stretch of theological imagination. It's not like that. We are God's people. God is the one who we're following. We are all following God together. Right? Is that clear? Do I need to belabor that? We're all real, real clear about that. We used to joke back in the early days of the church when we met down at the Gateway building. Some of our ushers were ornery back then. And people would come to the door of the Gateway and not sure. And they'd say, is this Charlie Dean's church? And some of our ushers were ornery. And they'd say things like, no. It's Imago Dei Church, which I loved. Give them the business right when they walk in the door. Let's just be real clear. This is God's flock. And then another important caveat he gives is that to the elders, you're to care for God's flock. Here it is. Be shepherds of God's flock that is under your care. It is not my job to worry about the flock at any other church in this city. Not my business. It's not my business what X church does and Y church does and them and her. And I heard this thing's going on over there. It's not my job to speculate, to criticize, to condemn, to spread rumors. None of it. My role as an elder at this church, the role of all of our leaders in this church, is not to worry about what's happening out there, but we're supposed to care for this place. We're supposed to care for God's flock that gathers here. This is the scope. Is that clear? All right? So we know what's going on there. And I'll tell you, like in our world today, I don't know about how any of you, but I hear it. I hear people all the time, well, this church is doing this thing and over here, and this thing goes over here, and what about this? It's not my thing. What I'm called to do in our context is I'm supposed to, the best way I know how, to care for God's flock that gathers here at 2221 North Gale Avenue. That's the flock I'm supposed to be caring for, not every other one. And then he says to the elders, be good shepherds. Now, for Peter, where does this language of being a good shepherd come from? Any ideas? Theories?
Jesus.
Good answer. If you don't know what else to say, say Jesus. Where specifically from Jesus? No, that's Paul. Nice try. You're thinking, though. I like it. Good effort. Where does Peter get the idea of being a shepherd from in terms of Jesus? There's an episode. Feed my sheep. That walking on the seashore post-resurrection, post-Peter's denial. Remember this episode from this summer where they're walking on the sheep, or they're walking on the sheep? That's just a funny image. They're walking on the beach, and Jesus says to Peter, who their last encounter was Peter swearing, I had never known the blink, blink, blink man, and running out, and the cock crows three times, and then they meet on the beach. And Jesus says to Peter, do you love me? And Peter says, well, of course I love you. And Jesus says, feed my sheep. And that happens three times. And so this language of shepherding and sheep and all that is one not only that would be familiar to an agrarian society, but one that's deeply personal to Peter. That maybe that day on the seashore, Peter got this analogy of what it meant to be an apostle in his head, and this is what resonates with him deeply, is this idea of shepherd and flock relationship. And I'm not going to do it because I want to leave us plenty of time to finish, but you can go to Acts 20, where Paul kind of is telling his story about how he was a good shepherd to people, and he explains that and lays it out there, and you can look at that later. And then he talks about the thing about not being under compulsion, so the idea that they do it willingly, but then the other side of that is they're doing it willingly, but they're not doing it in a way that's motivated by greed. That this is not something that a pastor, the people aren't being overseers for what they can get out of the relationship. And you can go through the Bible even and go back to the Hebrew scriptures and you see the stories, remember, of the priests who take more, and often in the prophets, criticisms of the priests who take the sacrifices for themselves instead of offering it to God. And this warning to be careful about greed. Listen, I know that, I'll just tell you from where I sit, talking about pastor salaries is ugly business because everybody has an opinion, right? And it's ugly. In fact, there was a big to-do in the last couple weeks about a pastor who was building a $2 million house, and that made the news all across the country and all kinds of discussions. And so somewhere in this conversation and somewhere actually in my life, there needs to be people talking about what's motivating you? If you're motivated by making money, if you're motivated, and I would say it even goes beyond greed, if you're motivated by the praise and whatever else comes with the perks of the job, if those are the things that are motivating you, that's not the position in which you serve. And he's going to talk about the attitude in which we serve in just a minute after we talk to the followers. So then to the youngers, he says, just simply submit yourself. Now, we've seen this word in Peter before. Where did Peter use this word of submission? Two other places. He refers to submitting to two other kinds of people. Who are they? Slaves to whom? What kind of masters? Evil, unreasonable, that's even a better word. Unreasonable masters, masters who beat you for doing good. And Peter asks slaves to willingly submit to those masters. And then what does he say to, who else is he asked to submit? Wives, to whom is he asking them to submit? Unbelieving husbands, specifically unbelieving husbands. And if you weren't here, we pointed out that the unbelieving husband, the reason for this is that it would have been required in a Roman household for a wife to change her religion to match her husband's. And so what Peter's calling these wives to do is to keep following Jesus. So disobey your husband, but show him honor and respect. So this word submit is in that kind of terminology. So in 1 Peter, for those of you that have been around a while, we say submit means what? I just used the two words. Honor and respect, it never means what? Obey. It never means obey. So for Peter, Peter is very, very clear. Now get ready. Everybody's on in this one. We only obey Jesus, God. Come on, I was hoping everybody. We only obey
Jesus.
Good. We obey Jesus, but we respect and honor people in positions of authority in our lives. Is that really, really clear? That when we talk about obedience, we do what God says. We do what Jesus says. But when it comes to our elders, when it comes to unreasonable masters, when it comes to our non-believing spouse, we honor and respect because we cannot always obey. We should not always obey. And so that's the context here. So he's not asking for blind obedience. I tell the first service, if you are ever sitting in my office looking for counsel and I say to you, well, I'm the pastor, you have to do what I say, you should run along and report me to somebody somewhere and kick my butt out of my office, because that's not what he's thinking of at all here. He's talking about a willing deference to those in authority over us. But then, of course, the caveat to all is clothing ourselves in humility. That this relationship only works when we choose humility. Now let's back up again. Rewind in the life of Peter. Where might Peter have gotten ideas about the leader is humble? Because he sure didn't get them from Roman culture. Roman culture, Greek culture, was very much shame, honor, dominance, strong men, lording over. Where did Peter get ideas about leaders clothing themselves in humility? Jesus, yay! Where specifically from Jesus? The washing of feet, perhaps. That this is the Jesus. Remember how much we talked about in the life of Peter, how much Peter loves and admires. Peter and Jesus almost appear in scriptures to be like best friends. This is the Jesus who got down on the floor and washed Peter's feet. Can you imagine how much that event would shape you? And then also, this is the same Peter who heard Jesus say things like, you see the Gentiles lording it over those whom they lead, but not for you. You must be servants of all. And so these words and actions of Jesus 30, 40, 50 years later for Peter are echoing through his letter of, this is what Jesus taught us. That even as we lead, we do so in ways that show humility. So we moved in here about a month and a half ago, and when we did, I had an empty wall in my office, and I needed some artwork. And there's a piece of artwork I've been looking at for a while, and it's called The Trinity by Andrei Rublev out of the Russian Orthodox tradition. It's considered the most popular, I guess, icon in the Russian Orthodox tradition. The three figures represent the... Trinity, thank you. It's right there. The three figures represent the Trinity. And what's significant? So in an icon, what an icon is supposed to do is it's not necessarily supposed to be something pretty, but an icon in the Orthodox tradition is supposed to draw us into prayer and reflection. You're supposed to sit in front of an icon, and you've seen us use the Pantocrator before if you've been around. It also hangs in my office. But you're supposed to sit and look at an icon and contemplate it and meditate on it and use it as a guide to enter into prayer. Two things I want to point out about this icon that I think are really significant. There's other things going on too, but two. One is that if you were taking a good art class, all right, this figure is drawn wrong. How? Way, way too big. How should this figure be drawn? Smaller to show what? To show perspective. There's no perspective here. It's flat. And the reason Rublev did that is to show what? Why might he show all three figures the same size? To show equality in the Trinity. But then, really significant for us this morning as we wrap this up, what's their posture towards each other? This is what I love most about this, by the way. They're bowing to each other. That what Rublev is trying to communicate in the painting of the Trinity is that the Trinity eternally nods to each other. That there's a humility within the Trinity towards each other. That you see in the words of Jesus this deference to the Father and deference to the Spirit, and you see this relationship. I've heard people call this the beautiful dance of the Trinity, in which they're in eternal deference to each other. Not my will, but yours be done, the deference to each other. And that this then becomes a model for what it looks like to lead and to follow in the local church, that we're in deference, we're following, we're nodding to. That whether we're the leaders or we're the followers, and I would suggest that many of us find ourselves in both of those roles, regardless of the position you hold in the church, maybe as a parent, in your family, you sit in place of leadership. So you do so with humility, in deference, bowing the head to the other. And when we all do that, when we sit in the pews and we sit in leadership teams and we all do so with an attitude of clothing ourselves in humility, that it's not about this particular position I have, it's about deference to the needs of the flock. And the congregation is doing that back and saying, wow, we don't always get leaders and we don't understand the decision, but we show deference to and we respect and we try to honor as best as we can. Even when we disagree, we don't have to necessarily obey, but we show deference to and respect. When that happens, there's this beautiful... there's this beautiful thing that starts to happen, which is what Peter's all about. Remember that Peter's writing to a church that's facing persecution, and his concern throughout this letter has been, how do you be the people of God in a culture that's increasingly violent? In a culture that's increasingly less hospitable to be a believer in Jesus, how do you be the church? And he defines this church even then. He described marriages as this unique place that respond to each other in ways unique to the culture. And then even in the church, the way we structure it in the church doesn't mirror society, but it stands in juxtaposition to it, that we relate to each other differently, that there's a different dynamic working between those who lead and those who follow. Let me tell one story, and then I'll finish. Of what this might look like in local church setting. About, I think it's 3 or 4 years ago now, a friend of mine in our church, who happens to also be in leadership, but said, I'm at this point in my life where I'm facing a career change, this job or this job, and I don't know which one to do. And so he asked a group of 5 or 6 other guys that he knew and trusted to sit with him and said, I don't know what to do and I need the community to help me decide this. And so on I can't remember what night of the week it was, after our kids were all in bed, we met at Donnelly's and we had a beer together and we sat and we asked questions of him. And we worked through this as a group together. Because one of the things I think in this passage that I see is he talks about submitting to elders. I think it rarely looks like, you know, you come to me and I tell you what to do. But rather it's groups of us together working through that. And so it was really interesting. In the night, we just kept asking questions, mostly asking questions, not giving advice, trying to help him find what the Spirit of God was saying in him. And we got to this space in the conversation, and somebody asked a question that just, when he answered it, it was like one of these moments where everybody's like, cool, and then like, whoa, that's it. And even the guy that was the one who started this whole thing just went, okay, it's decided. That there was something about the humble back and forth of willing submission to people that I see as authorities in my life and allowing them to speak it. And there was this beauty and goodness into how that decision happened. And I wish it always worked like that. I promise that I'll botch it. I promise that I'll do it wrong. And I promise that there'll be days where it's not very humble. And I'll promise that I don't oversee so well or whatever, you know, my responsibility side of it is. But I think that's the ideal. And I think it's scary. It's scary in our highly individualistic culture to say, I'm going to choose to let this group of people speak into my life. And I'm going to choose that I'm not just going to, you know, like Twitter, like you don't like somebody you're following, you drop them like a bad habit. I'm going to choose that even when the people in my life say things to me that are challenging, I'm not going to run away from that, but I'm going to lean into it. I think for most of us, if we're honest, that scares us to death. It scares us. But there's also that something that appeals to us. There's something about being in communion with people, of getting some clarity about what God is calling us to do. I don't know about you, but that excites me at some level, to live in that kind of way with people, that it's not just up to Charlie to figure out what to do in my life, but there's people around me in the church helping me find those things. And I think that's beautiful. And I know for some of us, been burned by passages like this before, but I think this is where we're trying to walk into and step into and ask, what does it look like if we're a church that does that kind of thing clothed in humility? Let's pray. God, I don't even know how to pray to begin to do all these things, and yet we see this, I just see a beautiful picture. And so help us to walk humbly with each other, to love each other deeply, to forgive faults, figure out how to be this kind of church. Father, for those of us that lead in this church, help us to be leaders that are clothed in humility. And for those of us that follow, help us to be people that are clothed in humility. Help us all to have that as the thing that undergirds the whole thing. And God, for all of it, I think Peter's heart and our heart is then that we reflect you to a culture that may not even understand the way we relate to each other. And that's the goal. And so be with us in all this. Father, be with us as we go about our days and our weeks. Help us to see every moment as latent with the possibility of you. In your name I pray, amen.